New Testament Prophecy by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract of the talk. A series of prophecies made by Jesus and Paul are shown either to have been fulfilled in the centuries following that, or is apparently in the process of now being fulfilled. The Bible, the sacred book of Christianity, tells us that there's a God, that he has told us things we need to know. What he is like, who we are, where we came from, how we have turned away from God, and what he has done to bring us back. What's our response going to be? Well, many of us do not like the Bible's message. We prefer a God of our own design, or no God at all. Why should we believe the Bible is anything more than wishful thinking or the guesses of ancient people? Well, as it happens, the God of the Bible claims to control history and to know the end from the beginning, and that sometimes he reveals things about history to the prophets, secrets about himself, secrets about the future. We want to look in this talk at some prophecies made in the Bible, made before the events happened. We're just going to look at New Testament examples, although other PowerPoint talks we have here give examples from the Old Testament as well. We're going to suggest that these fulfilled prophecies provide strong evidence that the Bible is not just guesswork. First, we will look at some cities of Galilee. At the time of Jesus, Galilee was a prosperous and densely populated part of Israel. We want to look at three cities here: Bethsaida, Chorazin, and Capernaum. Bethsaida is located in this map at the northeastern corner of the Sea of Galilee, and our map here is oriented with east to the top. Chorazin is located more around towards the northwest side of the Sea of Galilee and back up in the hills, and Capernaum down on the coast between the two. Jesus made predictions about these cities. He often taught in and around these towns. Capernaum was his home base in Galilee. Because many in these towns rejected his message even after seeing his miracles, Jesus warned them of disaster to come. In Matthew 11, verses 20 through 24, he says, "Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! For if the miracles had occurred in Tyre and Sidon, which occurred in you, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. Nevertheless, I say to you, it shall be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon in the day of judgment than for you. And you, Capernaum, will not be exalted to heaven, will you? You shall descend to Hades. For if the miracles had occurred in Sodom, which occurred in you, it would have remained to this day." So Jesus here names three specific cities: Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum. The remark, "it would remain to this day," indicates Jesus is not talking only about the destiny of individuals in these cities, but about the survival of the cities themselves. Well, let's take a little bit of look at the subsequent history of these cities. Each of these cities survived difficult times in the wars between Rome and Israel in the century following. Each was later destroyed in the Arab period. Today, none of these survive, and even their locations were lost for centuries. The location of Capernaum was rediscovered in the 19th century. Here in this picture, it's in this clump of trees here. Its most prominent ruin is its synagogue, and the synagogue has been partly restored using the stone from the synagogue that was not taken off and used for rebuilding elsewhere. Otherwise, the town is really merely rubble. Here we see a shot of the synagogue. Chorazin, located a few miles up in the hills above Capernaum, it too is just a ruin today. Perhaps Jesus spoke in its synagogue. Its people were unwilling to admit their sin before a holy God and turn back to him. Bethsaida too is gone. Its site has only recently been located, buried under the silt deposited by the Jordan River. were many cities in Galilee at Jesus' time, and there are many today. A number survive from antiquity: Tiberias, Nazareth, Cana. But our three cities are gone, the only Galilean cities Jesus condemned. Is that just an accident? Well, let's see. Jerusalem. Jerusalem was the religious center of Israel in Jesus' time. Jews from all over the Roman Empire came to worship there. It was a large city with massive walls and strong towers to defend the gates. Here we see a picture of Jerusalem at New Testament times in the model at the Holy Land Hotel in Jerusalem. The upper city was the wealthy section, home of the upper priesthood and successful merchants. The lower city was more modest, but still rather prosperous. There was much trade because the crowds of pilgrims, especially at the major festivals. As with the cities of Galilee, Jesus warned of disaster to come, but his prophecy takes a different turn for Jerusalem. He said, "When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, let those who are in the city depart." He also predicted what would happen to the city for centuries to come. Here we see it in Luke 21, verses 20 through 24. "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is at hand. Then let those who are in the midst of the city depart, and let not those who are in the country enter the city. There will be great distress upon the land and wrath to this people. They will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled." Well, what happened? The Romans surrounded Jerusalem in AD 64, early in the Jewish revolt against Rome. But then, unaccountably, they withdrew. Those who believed Jesus' words about what was going to happen in Jerusalem got out of the city and did not return. Those who ignored his words flocked to the city as the best fortified in the land, and they were destroyed in the siege and capture which followed. How do we explain something like this? The events of 66 to 70 AD fit Jesus' prediction so well that some resort to claiming that they were invented after that time and dishonestly put in Jesus' mouth. This ignores the historical evidence that Luke was written in the late 50s or early 60s, before these events happened. It also ignores the fact that Jesus predicted the status of Jerusalem for centuries to come. Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Well, let's look at the history of Jerusalem. This is just what happened. The Romans left Jerusalem a ruin for over 50 years. Then about 135 AD, they built a pagan city on the site named Aelia Capitolina, with pagan temples to desecrate the Jewish and Christian holy places. Jerusalem was trampled down by pagan Romans from AD 70 to about 325. The picture right is from a mosaic map of Jerusalem representing this time period. When Constantine, a Roman emperor in the 4th century, adopted Christianity, he removed the pagan temples from the Christian sites in Jerusalem. The Jewish temple site was left empty. Jerusalem continued to be trampled down by Gentiles, but now the Christian Romans, from 325 to 637 AD. Muslim Jerusalem. Muhammad, founder of Islam, led his followers on a holy war, which burst out in the Arabian Peninsula about 630. The Muslims took Jerusalem in 637. The Gentile Muslims controlled Jerusalem until the Crusades took it away in 1099. Crusader Jerusalem, European crusades to win back the Holy Land from the infidel Muslims, succeeded briefly. Jerusalem was taken with the slaughter of all its inhabitants in 1099. Gentile crusaders controlled Jerusalem until it was taken back by the Gentile Muslims, now Turks, in 1187. Turkish Jerusalem. The Turks held Jerusalem, except for a brief time under the Egyptian Muslims, until the end of World War I. Here we see a sketch of Jerusalem as it looked in AD 1839. At the end of World War I, the League of Nations gave control of Palestine to the British. Gentile British continued their mandate until 1948, when the United Nations divided Palestine into two nations, one Arab and one Jewish, as seen in the map at right. Jerusalem today. The war which followed a British withdrawal left the control of the old city in Arab hands. But in the Six-Day War of 1967, Israel regained the old city, and Jerusalem ceased to be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles for the first time in 1900 years. If we try to summarize this, just as Jesus said, Jerusalem, unlike the three Galilean cities, continued to exist as a city. Yet for centuries it remained under Gentile control, though it was the most holy site in Judaism. Finally, as Jesus said, it has once more come under Jewish control. Though Jesus, with other prophets of the Bible, predicts still future troubles for Jerusalem, his predictions in Luke 21, 20-24 have been fulfilled in detail. A number of these details came long after the latest possible date at which Luke could have been written. For a third prophecy, let's turn to look at the temple at Jerusalem. Jesus not only predicted the future of Jerusalem, but also that of the temple there. The so-called Second Temple was built in 515 BC to replace Solomon's temple, destroyed 70 years earlier by the Babylonians. Just before the time of Jesus, Herod the Great completely rebuilt it, producing the magnificent structure shown in this Jerusalem model. Herod's temple, which stood from 20 BC to 70 AD, was one of the marvels of the ancient world. The temple proper was a large marble building trimmed with real gold, seen in the background of this picture. A huge stone terrace, about 700 by 1,500 feet, surrounded it, and that takes up most of the midground in this picture. We see the southern wall and the southern portico of that large stone terrace. Colonnades with roofs over 75 feet tall provided shaded walkways. We see the southern one of these in this picture. Jesus' predictions about the temple. As Jesus left the temple for the last time in his earthly career, he mentioned what would happen to it. The disciples were pointing out all the impressive buildings on the terrace. Jesus said not one stone of them would be left upon another. Matthew 24, verses 1 and 2. And Jesus came out from the temple and was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. He answered and said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here shall be left upon another, which will not be torn down." This is exactly what happened. When the Romans finally managed to break through the city walls in the summer of AD 70, they captured and burned the city. Although it's claimed that the Roman general Titus did not want to destroy the temple, somehow a fire broke out and consumed it. The Jewish historian Josephus was an eyewitness of these events. In Book 7 of his Jewish War, he describes the destruction in these words: "The army, having no victims either for slaughter or plunder, Caesar ordered the whole city and the temple to be razed to the ground." Temple site today. Now not a single building on the temple terrace survives from before AD 70. Archaeologists are not even agreed where the temple was located on the platform. Some think it stood where the Dome of the Rock now stands, shown in this picture. Others put it about 100 meters to the north. We see in this map the two alternative locations that have been suggested. Only the retaining wall of the temple terrace remains to indicate something of the temple's magnificence. Here we see a picture of the western, or the so-called Wailing Wall. Jesus' words were fulfilled exactly. We have evidence of two attempts to thwart Jesus' prophecy by the most powerful humans then living. Titus, the general who took Jerusalem in AD 70, tried to preserve the temple. In spite of this, the temple was destroyed. Several centuries later, the Roman Emperor Julian tried to rebuild it. He did this despite the Christians, since they believed it would not be rebuilt until just before Jesus returns. Julian ordered the work, provided materials, and encouraged Jewish participation. The night before the rebuilding was to begin, there was a disastrous earthquake. Thereafter, strange phenomena interfered with the work until it was finally abandoned. Several accounts survive, including one from the very year of the event. We quote here, however, from an early pagan account by a friend of the emperor. Ammianus Marcellinus tells us, eager to extend the memory of his reign, Julian's reign, by great works, Julian planned at vast cost to restore the once splendid temple at Jerusalem, which after many mortal combats during the siege by Vespasian, later by Titus, had barely been stormed. He'd entrusted the speedy performance of this work to Alypius of Antioch. But though this Alypius pushed the work on with vigor, aided by the governor of the province, terrifying balls of flame kept bursting forth near the foundations of the temple and made the place inaccessible to the workmen, some of whom were burned to death. And since in this way the element persistently repelled them, the enterprise halted. Somewhere in the temple, not only were Jesus' words fulfilled, but strong attempts to thwart the prediction were turned aside. Was this just luck, or is the Bible really a revelation from the God who controls history? Another type of prophecy which occurs frequently in the New Testament regards Jesus' return. One day, Jesus will return to earth to rescue his followers and bring judgment to all who are in rebellion against God. Jesus himself made such predictions, so did his disciples, Peter, Paul, and John. But Jesus has not yet returned, so how can we know he will? Many, such as the late Bishop Pike, claim Jesus was mistaken. There'll be no second coming, they say, because Jesus and the apostles believed it would happen in the first century in their own generation. Various Bible passages have been used in seeking to prove this. Yet the Bible predicts just such a reaction on the part of believers. In 2 Peter 3:4, they're predicted as saying, "Where's this promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation." Thus those who deny the second coming fulfill a prediction by their very denial. Not only does the New Testament predict the return of Jesus and denials thereof, it also makes further predictions about conditions in the last days before its return. Paul, writing to his associate Timothy, characterizes the days that immediately precede Jesus' return. Here's what he says in 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 through 7. Paul says, "At that time, things will be dangerous because men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious gossips, without self-control, brutal, haters of good, treacherous, reckless, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, holding to a form of godliness, although they've denied its power." Is this being fulfilled today? It looks like our generation is characterized by this list of sins. We live in a time of great self-indulgence. We're lovers of self and lovers of pleasure to an unusual degree. The 20th century saw some of the worst wars in history, some of the most brutal governments, a general collapse of morals that may be unprecedented in scope. Truly, these are dangerous times. There have always been criminals today, but crime is rampant in our cities because men are disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, brutal, haters of good, treacherous. The very fabric of society is being threatened. Sexual immorality has been common in many societies, though Christian influences tended to drive it underground. But the recent collapse of moral standards, plus the technology of birth control, has led to an explosion of extramarital sex and venereal diseases, most recently AIDS. Truly, our age is one of the in which people are unholy, unloving, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Many criminal acts of a century ago are now legal. Fewer crimes are being solved. A smaller fraction of convictions are being obtained. Yet we face a serious problem of overcrowding in our prisons. Crime must really be rampant if this is so. With all our problem convicting criminals, it's not surprising that civil lawsuits have increased. We cannot find honest behavior or get satisfaction from the law, so we pay a lawyer to sue for us, or use lawsuits and threats to browbeat others. Truly, men today are arrogant revilers, irreconcilable, malicious gossips, Police are increasingly unable to protect the law-abiding citizens. Individuals are having to form neighborhood surveillance teams. Sales of watchdogs, burglar alarms, locks, and firearms are rising dramatically as crime spreads to neighborhoods once thought safe. Other symptoms are broken families, child neglect, child abuse, abortion. People no longer seem to be able to sacrifice their own freedom and pleasure to the welfare of their marriage and family. They've become lovers of self, lovers of money, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Perhaps corporations have always had better reputations than they deserve, yet the collapse of absolute moral standards has encouraged far more unethical activity by businesses, just as it has for individuals. What's the point of all this? There have always been people who fit the categories of 2 Timothy 3. What makes this generation notable is the rejection of absolute moral standards. This is a spinoff from the view that evolution has shown religion as man-made and moral standards are arbitrary. Here again, the New Testament has predicted a phenomenon of considerable importance. Well, let's summarize what we've talked about. We've looked at a number of passages in the New Testament where it speaks of things still future when it was written, but which now come to pass. It gives a list of cities to be destroyed. It sketches the future of Jerusalem, its destruction, its control by the Gentiles, its return to Jewish control. The desolation of Jerusalem's temple occurred and continued in spite of powerful attempts to thwart it. The scoffing of unbelievers regarding Jesus' second coming itself fulfills the prediction. Terrible conditions due to widespread moral decay seem now to be in the process of fulfillment. What should we do? Some claim these examples are merely a string of lucky guesses by ancient writers. Others that these were contrived by me to make the Bible look good. Your reaction is rather foolish. At the least, we owe it to ourselves to get a Bible and see whether these things are really there. It would be foolish to go through life hoping that there's no such God as pictured in the Bible, and then find out too late that there is. Right now, there's still time to do something about it. We can follow the example of the people who first heard the Apostle Peter proclaim the resurrection of Jesus. When they suddenly realized they were under God's condemnation, they asked Peter what they should do. He told them to hate their sins and turn back to God. Like them, we must trust in Jesus, who by dying on the cross provides forgiveness in such a way that God can release us from our deserved punishment and still remain just. None of us knows how much time we have to make such a decision. We might die any moment. We might live another 50 years. All we know is that we have this moment, and the time is running out. Well, the end may be nearer than you think.